It's a Friday edition of the My Ag Life Daily News Report. Hello, everyone. I'm Lori Boyer. Taylor Charleston will be along here in just a little bit. He'll be talking about boosting the nutritional bounty of carrots and onions. I'll have a check-in of national and regional agricultural news as well with Outlook at Regional Ag News right after this word from our sponsor.
Do you know the nutrient use efficiency people? Yes, I'm talking about the folks at Verdesian Life Sciences that deliver crop insights and solutions so California crops grow to their full potential. From micros with a proprietary delivery system to solutions that help improve the uptake and assimilation of applied nutrients. Visit VLSCI.com to learn more about Verdesian solutions or to connect with a local representative right here in California.
In regional agricultural news, the U.S. Department of Labor said it has recovered $255,114 in back wages for 588 agricultural workers at five California farms. The investigations also found that the farms failed to follow through with certain obligations to H-2A visa management workers and imposed $54,617 in total fines. DOL said the farms did not provide meals or kitchen facilities, did not pay required inbound and outbound transportation and associated meal costs, and allowed workers to be transported unsafely. The agency also said that when farms did try to meet their obligations, the results were sometimes not up to the required standards. In addition to working conditions violations, the farms were found to have shortchanged of workers in terms of pay, not provided a contract at the time workers were hired, or not stated terms and conditions of the job. Here is a list of back wages recovered and penalties imposed. Adam Brothers Farming, $94,146 in wages recovered for 30 employees. They were fined just over $7,800 in penalties. Boa Vista Farms in Santa Maria, $43,297 in wages recovered for 28 employees. They were fined just over $5,300 in penalties. Profresco Incorporated in Santa Maria, $50,789 in wages recovered for 471 employees. They were fined just over $7,500 in penalties. SARC in Napomo, $34,996 in wages recovered for 42 employees. They were fined over $13,000 in penalties. And Toyota Farms LLC in San Martin, $1,885 in wages recovered for 17 employees. They were fined just under $21,000 in penalties. With 60% of the state now in extreme drought conditions, state officials are warning water right holders they should expect more curtailments during the peak irrigation season next month and in July. In a statement last week, the State Division of Water Rights said curtailments are expected to increase progressively through the spring and summer and continue in the early fall until significant precipitation occurs. The warnings of curtailments could also include senior water rights holders. Accordingly, water right holders and claimants should plan for reduced supplies, even if the water right or claim is not currently curtailed, that according to the Division of Water Rights. Drought emergency curtailment regulations were issued last fall by the California State Water Resources Control Board for certain watersheds in response to persistent dry conditions and spurred by a drought emergency declaration by Governor Gavin Newsom. Curtailment orders adopted last year are effective for up to 1 year unless readopted. The State Water Board is now considering renewed curtailment orders to readopt and extend newly revised draft drought emergency regulations. The State Water Board readopted regulations for the Russian River watershed last week, and it plans to do the same for the Scott River and Shasta River watersheds and the Sacramento San Joaquin Delta watershed. During a workshop last week, State Water Board staff heard comments on an updated method used to predict water supply and demand to determine needed curtailment levels. Water from the Delta contributes to the supply for more than two-thirds of Californians and is used to irrigate millions of acres of farmland. The state noted that only a small number of the more than 17,000 water rights in the Delta watershed are currently curtailed, but because supplies will diminish in coming months, it warned that all rights holders, including those with older or riparian rights, should prepare accordingly. Meanwhile, federal and state allocations for irrigation this summer have already been reduced or cut to historic levels. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, National Agricultural Statistics Service, in the latest Pacific Region Milk Production Report, milk production during April totaled 3.62 billion pounds. That was down 0.6% from April of 2021 and down 2.8% from March of 2022. The number of milk cows on farms in California was 1.72 million head, up 2,000 from April of 2021 and unchanged from March of 2022. Production per cow in California averaged 2,105 pounds, down 15 pounds from April of 2021 and down 60 pounds from March of 2022. New research claims to give wine grape growers, wineries, and insurance companies a better way to figure out whether wildfire smoke has damaged a crop on a vine, a concern that led to much fruit in Napa and Sonoma counties to go unpicked in 2021. But a key West Coast scientist in this field, while noting the advancements in the process of detecting smoke taint in a study, urges caution with promoting it as the best solution, given current lab capacity and crop insurance policies. Determination of smoke damage is critical because it can factor into payment of crop insurance claims. A team of California Central Coast scientists and laboratory analysts with North Coast Agricultural Advisors studied 218 wine and fruit samples for 8 major grape varieties from 21 appellations in California and Oregon, including the North Coast, from 2017 through 2021 vintages. Researchers at SC Laboratories analyzed the samples looking for signs of 6 chemical markers most associated with ashy, bitter, or smoky odors and flavors called smoke taint. They advocate for direct measurement of those biomarkers rather than the indirect measurement common now. They say it's a faster way to know how much of a problem, if at all, they will become as the wine is produced and before it reaches the bottle. The research also puts forward baseline pre-wildfire levels for those compounds across grape varieties by analyzing samples deemed affected and not affected by smoke. Led by UC Santa Cruz Oceanic biochemist and small-scale venter Phil Cruz, the research focused on one of the biggest problems with detection of current and future problems from these smoke compounds in grapes and wine. The issue came to the forefront after a string of Northern California wildfires started in 2015. Burning vegetation produces over 500 such volatile phenols. Nearly 3 dozen are associated with smoky odor and flavor, but a number of those are also connected with desired character given to wine via toasted barrels, according to the researchers. The group's paper noted how easily and quickly volatile phenols pass through the grape skin to become chemically bound to sugars in the berry. At that point, they become odorless. Only during fermentation or contact with enzymes in a taster's mouth are the volatile phenols released, called free compounds. Super tasters, or people with a greater density of taste buds, can detect more of these free volatile phenols, and up to 1/4 of the people are physiologically incapable of detecting them. Cruz admits that the direct measurement of the bound compounds runs counter to what's advocated by West Coast smoke taint researchers such as Anita Oberholzer of UC Davis. For the past few years, she has been recommending that growers and wineries conduct bucket ferments, also called microfermentations, of suspect grapes to give to labs as a sample of what the level of free volatile phenols the grapes contain.
There's giant potential sleeping in your soil. Under drought conditions, it's never been more important to wake it up. Phycoterra, a superior soil microbial food, activates the native microbes responsible for your soil's health and water-holding capacity. Adding Phycoterra to your crop increases water retention up to 10% and optimizes crop nutrient availability. Plus, it delivers excellent mixability and application flexibility, making it easy to add to your existing crop input strategy. Visit Phycoterra.com to learn how you can wake up your soil's giant potential with Phycoterra.
USDA ARS research scientists are leveraging the latest genomics tools and techniques to identify the specific gene or gene regions for health-promoting compounds in germplasm collections of onion and carrot so that they can be passed into elite commercial varieties, benefiting farmers in the field and consumers at the dinner table. Phil Simon, research leader of the ARS Vegetable Crops Research Unit in Madison, Wisconsin, is coordinating the effort to fortify these popular salad items and fresh market favorites with increased levels of beta-carotene, anthocyanin, and other phytonutrients. Onions, which belong to the genus Allium, along with garlic, are rich in phytonutrients.
We know there's some health components to onions that are healthy for you. And it actually is the flavor compounds that are the vehicle for the healthful aspects of onions in reducing things like arteriosclerosis and some pulmonary and circulatory diseases. They're somewhat blood thinning. And so that blood thinning aspect of things, it's the same thing as what people that take Coumarol are taking it for. And so that's why if you're taking Coumarol, you're not supposed to take onion, eat onion and garlic, but because you can get too thin of blood too. But the bigger problem tends to be that people in the U.S., for instance, eat foods that accumulate plaque in the bloodstream. Onions and garlic in the diet help thin them out. And so that's the research that Mike was involved in, Mike Havey, in onion improvement, to look at improving the nutritional value, and he found that there was a good correlation between the intensity of the flavor and the impact of the health value, of the nutritional value in terms of some of these blood thinning properties. This was done collaboratively with a colleague here at the University of Wisconsin, Erwin Goldman, looking at some of those blood thinning properties. And so as a geneticist, then you ask the question, gee, I can do one thing to say this onion has more of these compounds than that one. While we're at it, let's try and figure out what the genetic control of these compounds is in a genetic breeding project. And that's where the genomics part of it comes in. You can do the breeding without the genomics, but it really facilitates the whole process very significantly. And this is not GMO. This is just measuring genetic variations, or like 23andMe on a large scale for lots of onion and carrot plants.
The carrot side of the project is similar, according to Simon, who's working to increase the beta carotene content of carrot varieties now grown, which, along with other carotenoids, ranges from 45 to 200 parts per million. Beta carotene is a key pigment that gives this root crop its appealing orange color. But when carrots are consumed, the beta carotene in them becomes something even better, a leading dietary source of vitamin A, which is critical to human health and well-being.
Most carrots we're familiar with are orange, and it's been known for a long time that ultimately all of the vitamin A in the U.S. diet comes from those orange pigments in the fruits and vegetables that we eat. You can find these pigments in lots of different sources in the diet, but carrots are the richest source based on some very good data that the USDA collects on foods that we eat. What we've been doing is, as we're developing carrots with better disease resistance, developing carrots with better flavor, is to also look at the genetic variation of those carrots. So we've got a collection of, let's say, 50 carrots that we know compared to 1,000 other carrots are better for disease resistance. Of those 50, some are darker orange than others. So what we do is when we're providing seed to the seed companies and to growers and consumers, is we'll focus particularly on those with more nutritional value and then include information about the nutritional value, usually when we're giving that seed away for the seed companies to use. So again, like the onion flavor story, we already started with an orange product with carrots, but 40 years ago, you know, people will say, gee, Phil, you've been working on this project a long time. I haven't seen these carrots. Where are they? And they're there. The carrots that you and I are eating today, the average carrots in the grocery store, the big grocery stores across the country, the average carrots are roughly 40% higher in these orange pigments than they were in the 1970s. So anyway, so we look at improving the nutritional quality of carrots that do have better grower traits for production, better flavor, and also try to throw in the nutritional value, because we know the grower isn't going to get a better price for the darker orange carrots or the more nutritious onions. We just look at, since we're in a public sector program, we have seed that we give to seed companies. They use it, so why not do what we can to make them more nutritious?
Using genomic mapping techniques, Simon's group is hunting for so-called markers that can flag the presence of the specific gene or genes that ratchet up the production of these phytonutrients in carrot and onion. With these markers figuratively in hand, breeders could use marker-assisted selection to check for the presence of those genes in the progeny of two parent varieties without waiting for the young plants to fully mature, saving time, money, and resources.
We'll take best carrot that we have available in my breeding program now with pretty good flavor, pretty good color, maybe no disease resistance, and intercross this new source of, let's say, a new disease resistance we found, or higher carotene. So you cross this carrot with an orange carrot, an orange level, pigment level of the 1970s amount with one with a 2020 amount. And in the progeny, you're going to find a range of colors, some less than that 1970 carrot, and some more than a darker orange carrot. And so then we grow all those out and we evaluate them for whatever we think the grower and the consumer will want. And it'll include, in this case, we're looking for more pigment. So we typically don't look for just that. We look for this in addition to, you know, the genes for flavor, let's say. So that's what, so the process is one for developing molecular tags for the genes along the chromosomes of the plant, and then asking, can we use those molecular tags to help us speed the process up? So if you want to grow carrots for flavor improvement or disease evaluation, you're going to have to grow the crop and then wait until, you know, probably 100 days or more to evaluate the flavor and disease resistance. Can we do something where we can just take a snippet of leaves from 100 plants and evaluate the DNA on it, and with that say, well, the snippet from the leaf of plant number 14 has what we know is the version of the gene that's important for boosting the carotene content, and also has the genes for disease resistance and good flavor. Let's use that one and focus on that one when we're growing it. So we can cut back on the number of plants we grow, and we can cut back on the speed at which we make decisions, because, you know, this whole process is kind of slow. We can intercross these carrots once a year, and then we wait another year before we do it again. So we want to do what we can to speed it up.
The researchers are also looking for markers linked to agronomic traits like pest and disease resistance, opening the door to new varieties that reduce production costs for growers and improved nutritional health for consumers. This is Taylor Chalstrom reporting for MyAgLife.
Sponsored by the California Walnut Board and Commission, delivering value to growers and handlers with advocacy, research programs, and walnut promotions. Doing more together.
In national agricultural news now, the Consumer Brands Association cautioned that rising costs on manufacturers have not slowed and show no signs of doing so. Citing data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics last week, the April Producer Price Index showed an 11% year-over-year rise. For food specifically, wholesale prices rose 14.5%, showing the outsized impact that consumer packaged goods companies are feeling. Consumer Brands President and CEO Jeff Freeman says this is a 14th straight month that they have seen wholesale prices push above the historical trend line. He says the percentages may fluctuate month to month, but the story has remained the same. The cost to make and ship goods is out of control. Since the pre-pandemic era, wholesale costs for the industry have increased 35%. The spike significantly impacts industry operations, as approximately 70% of CPG companies' costs come from ingredients and energy. Further, key commodities showed sharp increases over last April, along with freight and fuel. House lawmakers Abigail Spanberger, a Virginia Democrat, and Anthony Gonzalez, an Ohio Republican, have introduced the American Food Supply Chain Resiliency Act this week. The bipartisan legislation seeks to strengthen supply chains across the agriculture industry and lower food costs for consumers. The bill would establish supply chain regional resource centers through cooperative agreements with the Department of Agriculture. The centers would offer locally tailored coordination, technical assistance, and grants, leading to more resilient, diverse, and connected supply chains. machines. USDA recently announced its intention through the Agricultural Marketing Service to create regional food business centers. The Spanberger-Gonzalez legislation would codify the centers, renaming them Supply Chain Regional Resource Centers. Under the legislation, these centers would support supply chain coordination in their region, fund technical assistance providers to offer guidance to food businesses and farms, and provide small grants to entities looking to expand or start their operations in a certain region. U.S. milk production is running slightly behind last year, but may expand into 2023. USDA Ag News reporter Gary Crawford.
So far this year, U.S. dairies are producing a little less milk than they did by this time in 2021, with a few less cows than a year ago. The latest USDA milk production report putting April's milk output at 19.2 billion pounds, just about 1% less than April a year ago. The milk cow herd, smaller, down by 98,000 from April last year. Milk per cow, same as a year ago. USDA Outlook Board Chairman Mark Jekanowski is projecting this year's milk output to be 226.7 billion pounds.
And for 2023, that would increase to 229.5 billion pounds.
An increase of about 1%, enough of an increase to bring next year's all milk average price down from its record high 2022 price of $25.75 a hundredweight
to $23.55 per hundredweight,
reflecting that higher expected production. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
A recent economic study indicates public-private U.S. agricultural export market development programs remain highly effective and generate a substantial return on investment. The study, welcomed by the Coalition to Promote U.S. Agricultural Exports, was conducted by IHS Markit and Texas A&M University. The researchers say MAP and FMD have accounted for 13.7% or almost $648 billion of all revenue generated by U.S. agricultural exports between 1977 and 2019. In letters sent last month, members of the coalition and additional organizations asked U.S. House and Senate Agricultural Appropriations Subcommittee leadership to maintain funding of at least $200 million for the Market Access Program and $34.5 million for the Foreign Market Development Program in fiscal year 2023. Citing strong competition for growing global food demand, the organization said these modest investments are invaluable as they race to reclaim global export markets shut off during a pandemic and diversify markets amid war and geopolitical unrest. A recent effort by the Association of Equipment Manufacturers explores the future needs of food production. Michael Clements has the report.
The Association of Equipment Manufacturers' recent white paper, The Future of Food Production, identifies 13 trends expected to shape food production over the next 10 years. AEM President Megan Tennell says preparing the white paper was a collaborative effort by AEM members.
It was really a collective process where we brought together our agriculture-focused member companies, really the thought leaders within those companies, and they determined the impact on farmers by the changes that are happening in the agriculture industry. We've been doing this for over 2 years now, and it's really taking a look at the agriculture industry through the generous contribution of the time spent by our members involved in this research, discussion, debate, and finally consensus building.
The study offers a glimpse into the changes over the next 10 years in food production for farmers and equipment manufacturers.
The goal of this white paper is to present a look at the next 10 years of food production. It's providing information to help farmers prepare for the impacts that are emerging today and in the future. And obviously, as we represent the equipment manufacturers, we are hand in hand with the farmers. We've got to be partners together in this.
Top level trends, Tennell says, include water issues and the needed increase of food production.
Farmers have increasingly been asked to produce more while reducing their environmental impact. But what we see coming is a global population increase by roughly 2.2 billion in the year 2050. And that means farmers will have to grow about 70% more food. The evolution of technology from our OEMs is key, but really the adoption of that technology will be the main point in being able to meet the food production demands coming in the future. For us, one big way of doing that, of course, is with precision agriculture. Additional trends or things that we really need to keep an eye on, the optimization of water usage. Concerns about water depletion will drive technology adoption to improve soil management and optimization of water use.
She says it's an important effort that will help guide equipment manufacturers and farmers through the future.
Now, with global populations rising, food demand increasing, a shrinking skilled workforce, and the need for environmental conservation becoming more urgent, AEM and our member companies are committed to taking an active role in examining and shaping the future of agriculture so our members can offer equipment solutions and insights to help farmers succeed. We've got to work hand in hand to make sure that we can achieve the objectives to feed the world. Our member companies understand that a new way of thinking and doing business is necessary to address the food production challenges of tomorrow, and we hope the farmers will join us on this journey.
Tanel adds you can find the complete white paper online.
So as I mentioned, there's a lot of trends. So if you want that more information, you can head to our website. It's aem.org, and you want to search for Future of Food Production. There you're going to be able to download the whole white paper with all the 13 trends. But I encourage you to perhaps bookmark that section because we are already bringing our group back together again to do a deeper dive into the solutions. And we're going to share that information as well later this year.
Again, learn more and find the report online at AEM.org. Michael Clements reporting.
Unsure of your naval orange worm program? No worries now with Rango, a proven solution to protect your orchard at hull split from naval orange worm. Rango is an OMRI-listed, broad-spectrum biopesticide with no known resistance, making it an excellent rotation and tank mix partner for both conventional and organic growers. Partner with Rango today. Contact your PCA, local dealer, or visit rangonow.com. Rango, no worries now.
May Cullumber was recently named one of two presidential chairs for Tree Nuts at the University of California Division of Agriculture and Natural Resources. This title and the endowment that comes with it will be used to support her existing research and outreach as a University of California Cooperative Extension Nut Advisor.
My responsibility is going to be, and already really is in my current job, is to support the research in the area of soil and plant relations that contribute to the improvement of tree nut production and quality. The endowment that I'm receiving is provided from the Pistachio Research Board, so that emphasis will be on pistachios, although, you know, I do a lot of other work in tree crops. And so, and there's a lot of overlap in those production systems. So, you know, what we can learn that's beneficial for pistachios is probably also going to be likely beneficial for other commodities like almonds and walnuts. There's a lot of issues in California. The big ones are, you know, water scarcity. We have problems with degrading soil conditions. We're seeing increases in soil and water salinity. We're tending to see warmer winters, and crops like pistachios need a certain amount of chill to have a good crop for the coming year. So having a reduced chill is going to impact growers' ability to maintain their productivity. So the endowment will support the investigation of these issues and determine the best options to mitigate these problems. Well, along with, you know, everything else in society right now, you know, the cost of research is an extension is going up. And so these funds will support the day-to-day operations of my program. You know, it's going to help with personnel costs, field and laboratory supplies and equipment, sampling tools, soil sensors, weather stations, all of those type of things. I hope to, you know, in addition to some of the research things that I mentioned, conduct more outreach education. And so I'm hoping to put on more water management, water productivity workshops, and work that I'm already doing in cooperation with the California Department of Food and Ag programs to help growers evaluate their irrigation system performance, make improvements in their scheduling to increase their precision, and improve the efficient use of costly fertilizers.
Dr. Cullumber hopes to continue to tackle some of the biggest challenges in soil and water management by helping growers treat soil salinity and maintain efficient cover crops to preserve their soil.
We hope to make improvements in soil management and irrigation decisions that will help with the health and productivity of pistachio and other tree crops. We hope to make more useful hands-on tools for growers to utilize. So an example of that would be, you know, a lot of my correspondence and, you know, meeting with growers, we talk about, you know, what's the best way to interpret soil and water analyses. So in particular, if they're having problems with you know, salinity issues and saying, okay, you know, like I need to calculate what amendments are most appropriate, or, you know, what's the appropriate leaching fraction, you know, and when should I apply that water? You know, a lot of times that can be, you know, very complicated and confusing. And so, me and, you know, collaboration with a lot of other researchers, we're hoping to use some information from our research trials to develop an online calculator where we can put this information together along with information about their particular irrigation system to help provide leaching fraction advice along with, you know, amendment application advice. You know, there's been a big push for, you know, this concept of, you know, soil conservation and everything in ag. And we can commonly see the degradative effects of that, you know, a lot of things like repeated tillage or compaction from heavy equipment and all of these type of things have on the soil. And so that impacts the ability for water to infiltrate, to percolate through the soil, and to maintain, you know, healthy trees, healthy crops. So one of the trials that I'm involved with is that we're looking at different types of cover crops, like cool season grasses, that can generally be established with a minimal amount of water. And so, you know, in areas where of California, like the Southern San Joaquin Valley, where we tend to think that, you know, like, oh, we can't implement that practice here. You know, like we're doing some research to say, well, you know, if we use the right type of cover crop, you know, if we can use these annual cool season grasses, you know, how does that help with solving soil structural problems, mitigate those salinity problems? Well, we'll still, potentially improving the quality of the crop.
For My Ag Life Daily News, I'm Patrick Cotter.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
That will wrap up today's show. You've been listening to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Lori Boyer. From all of us here at the JCS Marketing team, thank you for listening.